The president-elect with a big announcement just minutes from now. I'm Shepard Smith. This is the news on CNBC.
We're asking to report any suspected violent or criminal activity.
Threats grow, fears rise, the nation on high alert. After calls for armed protest and more violence, law enforcement prepares for Inauguration Day like never before. The president-elect live in this hour on his plans to vaccinate more Americans and rescue the economy. But how will impeachment impact the new administration's agenda?
Infection is everywhere.
The COVID crisis, the winter surge even more dire as we prepare for more than 100,000 deaths in a single month. How quickly can a single dose be delivered?
Could be a sign of more depressing news to come.
Plus, unemployment surging higher than expected. Why some states are doing much better than others.
Live from CNBC, the facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith.
Just 6 days before Joe Biden takes office as president of the United States, tonight he'll address the nation. His focus, the number one crisis facing this country, the pandemic. His speech expected to be expected in about 15 minutes from now, live on CNBC. In the middle of a world altered like COVID, you sometimes lose sight of its enormity. It really has overtaken just about everything that really matters. The staggering death toll, killing on average 3,300 Americans a day. COVID has single-handedly crushed our once vibrant economy. We've mortgaged our financial future. Trillions spent, trillions more coming to help people survive. Millions of jobs lost. It's altered our politics. I mean, would President Trump be coming for a second term without it? And it's upended our lives and our lifestyles and our futures. Our response, by many measures, the very worst in all the world. So tonight, President-elect Biden is expected to outline his plan for slowing the COVID surge, his roadmap to fix this nightmare by speeding up the vaccine rollout and providing economic relief. The Labor Department reports another 965,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims last week. Hard to hire or find work with COVID restrictions hurting companies and businesses. Those numbers much bigger than expected. On the vaccine front, states are working to improve the rollout. Some are doing much better than others. Today, Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced his state has now administered 1 million doses. It's the first state in all the nation to do that. But many local leaders say they still don't have enough shots. Take California, for example. That state is now allowing people 65 and older to get vaccinated. But the health director in L.A. County says that is impossible right now. She says the county doesn't even have enough doses to finish vaccinating the healthcare workers who so desperately need them. CNBC's Kayla Tausche now. Kayla, vaccines top of mind for Americans. What do we expect from Mr. Biden in the way of a proposal tonight?
Well, Shep, the president-elect is expected to say that a national emergency of this size and scope demands a comprehensive and ambitious plan to both shore up the economy and control the pandemic. To that end, the package that he will unveil tonight will include $400 billion for the virus alone. That includes $50 billion for testing, $170 billion to help retrofit and reopen schools and colleges across the country, and the central pillar, establishing a national vaccination program, which the incoming administration says does not currently exist. The program they would stand up would see mass vaccination sites in urban areas, mobile units in lesser served areas, and it would make vaccinations free for everyone, even the lowest income Americans and undocumented immigrants. Senior Biden administration officials believe such a program could be enacted quickly once it's underwritten by Congress. And despite what they say are shortcomings of the Trump administration's effort, their goal, they believe, of inoculating 100 million Americans in the first 100 days is still within reach. Biden is expected to drill down on the vaccination effort more in another speech tomorrow. Of course, to enact this or any other vaccination program, the broader relief bill would need bipartisan support. And with a crowded and finite calendar that will now see an impeachment of the former president and confirmation hearings for the incoming president's cabinets, I asked a Biden advisor how this all gets done, and he used a phrase oft used in Washington, it's a walk and chew gum moment. Shep?
Kayla, the president-elect expected to unveil nearly $2 trillion in coronavirus relief. The plan's coming tonight. For context, the first stimulus package passed in March was $2.2 trillion, and the aid passed in December totaled $900 billion. Mr. Biden's plan expected to include a new push for bigger direct checks to qualifying Americans. Details on that a moment away. Of course, that was a point of contention on the Hill during the previous push for relief. The $2,000 checks passed the House of Representatives, remember, then died in the U.S. Senate. CNBC's Elon Moy live in Washington with new information tonight. Elon, tell us about the pitch we'll hear from the president-elect.
Shep, his central argument is that the health crisis is deeply connected to the economic crisis, and that's why half of the package, roughly $1 trillion, goes toward direct relief for workers and families. Another round of stimulus checks is topping the list, this time for $1,400, bringing the total amount between the last package and this one to the $2,000 that Democrats had promised. He also wants to tackle unemployment insurance, increasing the federal boost in jobless benefits from $300 to $400 a week, allowing workers to collect payments for longer, and expanding who can qualify. There's $30 billion in rental assistance and an extension of the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. Now, just about all of these ideas do have some Republican support, and many of them build upon the package that Congress passed just a few weeks ago. But one of the more controversial proposals that Biden is going to call for tonight is to raise the minimum wage by $15 an hour. Now, Democrats had set this goal many years ago, but Biden is now framing this as a way to help frontline workers, especially since a disproportionate number of them, 40%, are people of color. Biden's phrase is, let's not just praise them, let's pay them. Now, all of this stands a pretty good chance of passing the House, where Democrats do hold the majority. But Biden would still have to win over Republicans in the Senate if he wants to pass this bill through regular order. Tonight, he plans to make his case to both sides of the aisle by underscoring the urgency of getting more help to American families now. Shep, he's hoping that at least this first bill can be bipartisan.
Elon, thank you. We got some disturbing COVID news from researchers at Ohio State today. A new strain of the virus discovered here in America. They say it has mutations never before seen. They also say they found another strain that is identical to the one from the United Kingdom. The researchers say these mutations are likely to make the virus more infectious. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, now CNBC contributor, former FDA commissioner, also on the board of Illumina and Pfizer. Doctor, thanks as always. Please give us your assessment of these new strains and help us understand what they mean for all of us.
Well, look, this virus is evolving all the time, and these strains that we're seeing right now, particularly the UK variant and the variant in Brazil and South Africa, which are very concerning because they've mutated a part of the virus that we've targeted with some of our drugs, they don't seem to be the result of selective pressure in terms of the virus trying to make itself more fit, although it has become more fit. They seem to be variants that emerged in certain patients that may have had chronic infection and were unable to clear it. And then they developed these variants, and the variants then began to propagate. They led to secondary infections after that. So this is inevitable that this virus is going to mutate and evolve this way. I think what it underscores right now is the game's really changed when it comes to the vaccine rollout. And the goal is probably to get as much protective immunity into the population as possible right now, because the vaccine is really our only backstop against these variants taking hold. They're not prevalent here in the United States right now, the UK and the South Africa variant, based on the reporting that we have from the sequencing work that we're doing. But they're going to build very quickly. And if we can't get more protective immunity into the population, we could be facing a situation where we have sort of perpetual infection heading into the spring and the summer as these variants get a foothold here.
Perpetual infection, that means this would continue kind of like we are now, at these high, horrific numbers into the summer?
I think that's the risk. Right now, there are indications that the number of infections is starting to peak, and it doesn't feel that way because we're at the very apex of the epidemic right now. Deaths and hospitalizations, unfortunately, are going to continue to build because they're a lagging indicator. But the number of infections may be peaking. We see the positivity rate starting to decline. The rate of transfer, what's called the RT, seems like it's starting to decline. So we may enter a situation that as we head into February and as we head into the spring, March, you start to see infections come down more dramatically, in part because we've infected fully a third of the population, in part because we're vaccinating more people and the virus is starting to burn itself out. But then if these new variants take hold as we enter the spring, which is the risk, right now they're less than 1% of all infections, but they're going to build. And by March, they may be 10% of all infections. So if they continue to build, what could have been a relatively quiet spring and summer where we didn't see a lot of infection ends up being a summer where we have more infection because these variants are now circulating and they spread more easily, even in the warm months when we really shouldn't have had a lot of coronavirus spreading.
And we know what we have to do to stop that. We have to wear a mask. We have to stay distance. We have to maintain hygiene. We have to do it now more than ever. And doctor, there's more good news on the vaccine front. I read this new stuff from Johnson & Johnson just out today. Great data on how well this works with one shot. Are you confident in J&J, and how big a breakthrough would that be?
Well, look, I'm confident in Johnson & Johnson's ability to scale the manufacturing here, and that's really been one of the challenges. This does look good. The early data looked encouraging. One of the things that we saw in the data was that the antibody response continued to build even after about 2.5 months. So at day 71, you still saw patients having increasing levels of antibodies, which suggests that the immunity here that this vaccine confers may be enduring and may actually grow over time. So that's very encouraging. This vaccine can be stored in a refrigerator, so it could be delivered in more austere settings in the doctor's office. As you said, it could be delivered probably as a single injection. We need to look at the phase 3 data, which they're hopefully going to have the interim results in the next 2 weeks based on reporting, to see whether or not older individuals might need a second injection to get the full immune protection from this vaccine. But all in all, this looks very encouraging, and it's an indication we may have another vaccine as early as perhaps February on the market.
Man, that would be fantastic, and a one-shot vaccine to boot. Dr. Gottlieb, as always, thanks so much. Police chiefs across the country are told to be on high alert tonight, briefed by the FBI director himself, according to the reporting of NBC News. Now, hear this. The director, Christopher Wray, told the chiefs to take any threat of violence seriously. He outlined the chatter that the FBI has been tracking online, volumes of it, which includes threats to the inauguration, threats to state capitals across the country, and threats to the homes of our lawmakers. Now more than 24 House Democrats are demanding an investigation on whether their own colleagues, Congress members, helped the mob that stormed the Capitol. The Democratic Congressman Mikey Sherrill says that she saw members of Congress lead guests on what she described as a possible reconnaissance mission the day before the assault. There's another claim, too, one that comes from the office of the Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Her spokesperson says that panic buttons inside her office were removed when the riot broke out, removed before it. Now lawmakers are having to take security into their own hands. The Republican Congressman Peter Meyer is among them. He was our guest the other night. He voted for impeaching the president and says now he's taking serious precautions.
Many of us are altering our routines, working to get body armor, which is a reimbursable purchase that we can make. It's sad that we have to get to that point, but, you know, our expectation is that someone may try to kill us.
The nation's capital on heightened alert ahead of the inauguration. The Park Service considering whether to close the National Mall entirely. NBC's Ellison Barber live there tonight. Ellison, show us around if you can. What's it like?
Hey, Shepard. Yeah, you can hear the hammer behind me. They are putting up more barricades around this area. Barricades surround the U.S. Capitol. This one has gone up just within the last hour. There are military trucks just past the barricade at the ready. In front of them, there are some of the thousands of armed members of the National Guard who have been sent to the District of Columbia. By the time Inauguration Day officially comes around, we expect at least 20,000 members of the National Guard to be here in the nation's capital. They have come from at least six different states, as well as the District of Columbia. All of this, hopefully, enough to keep anyone who wants to do harm to this building or the people inside of it away. But despite all of this, the threats online, they have not stopped. There is talk in far-right extremist chat groups telling people to come to D.C., encouraging some to carry weapons. The FBI director said tonight, as he was briefing Vice President Mike Pence, that they are aware of that online chatter. They are evaluating it and trying to figure out what is just online talk and what is serious. And they had a warning for anyone trying to do something. He said, FBI agents are ready and we will hunt you down. Shepard.
Ellison, it seems in every crisis, there's almost always a hero. And we found them. A group of lawmakers introducing legislation to award the Congressional Gold Medal to a Capitol Police officer. Here's the story. During the riot on Wednesday, remember this video? Officer Eugene Goodman was able to lead a mob of people to chase him in the opposite direction of the Senate chamber. Come for me, don't go for the legislators. At the same time, the lawmakers were hunkered down, hiding inside in fear. They honor Officer Goodman for his bravery and quick thinking during last week's insurrection. The Congressional Gold Medal is the highest civilian award Congress can present. Past recipients include Rosa Parks and Nelson Mandela. In just a few minutes, we're expecting to hear from Joe Biden. This is a live look in Delaware, where the president-elect will lay out his $1.9 trillion stimulus plan for the country. Vaccinating America and getting more relief to the people. President-elect Biden to address the nation in a few minutes. In the dark, underground for more than 24 hours. The race against time to save trapped miners. Tumultuous final days in office for President Trump. His party splintering. What's the future for the GOP?
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 60 seconds.
President-elect Biden set to speak any minute from now, expected to outline his vaccine and COVID relief plans, urging Congress to act on both immediately. We'll bring you that live when it happens here on CNBC. Well, now to what Michigan's attorney general calls the largest criminal investigation in his state's history. The former governor there, Rick Snyder, could face up to a year in prison for his role in the Flint water crisis. Prosecutors are now charging Snyder with two counts of willful neglect of duty. A judge arraigned him today over Zoom. Snyder seen sitting in a jail booth next to his lawyer. His only words today, yes, Your Honor. Here's NBC's Gabe Gutierrez.
Shep, this saga had been building for years, and now some Flint residents say that these charges don't go far enough. Well, today, former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder pleaded not guilty to misdemeanor charges.
Interrupting because the president-elect has come to the microphone, let's listen to Joe Biden.
Took her last breath at home under the California sun in Santa Clara. She was 57 years old, a beloved wife, mother, daughter, sister. She never knew she had the virus at the time when most folks never heard about the virus. But just like that, she was gone. And almost exactly 1 year later, nearly 400,000 of our fellow Americans have met the same cruel fate. Countless families and friends left behind with unrelenting grief and guilt, anger and frustration. And the emptiness felt by the loss of life is compounded by the loss of our way of life. During this pandemic, millions of Americans, through no fault of their own, have lost the dignity and respect that comes with a job and a paycheck. Millions of Americans never thought they'd be out of work. Many of them never even envisioned the idea, are facing eviction, waiting for hours in their cars to feed their families as they drive up to a food bank. Millions have kept their jobs, but have seen their hours and paychecks reduced, barely hanging on as well. That's happening today in the United States of America. Just as in the midst of the dark winter of this pandemic, as cases, hospitalizations, and deaths spike at record levels, there is real pain overwhelming the real economy. One where people rely on paychecks, not their investments, to pay for their bills and their meals and their children's needs. You won't see this pain if your scorecard is how things are going on Wall Street. But you will see it very clearly if you examine what the twin crises of a pandemic and this sinking economy have laid bare. The growing divide between those few people at the very top who are doing quite well in this economy and the rest of America. Just since this pandemic began, the wealth of the top 1% of the nation has grown roughly $1.5 trillion since the end of last year, four times the amount for the entire bottom 50% of American wage earners. Some 18 million Americans are still relying on unemployment insurance. Some 400,000 small businesses have permanently closed their doors. And it's not hard to see that we're in the middle of the once-in-several-generations economic crisis with the once-in-several-generations public health crisis. The crisis of deep human suffering is in plain sight, and there's no time to waste. We have to act, and we have to act now. This is what economists are telling us. More importantly, it's what the values we hold dear in our hearts as Americans are telling us. A growing chorus of top economists agree that the moment of crisis, in this moment of crisis, with interest rates at historic lows, we cannot afford inaction. It's not just that smart fiscal investments, including deficit spending, are more urgent than ever. It's that the return on these investments in jobs, racial equity, will prevent long-term economic damage, and the benefits will far surpass the cost. A growing number of top economists has shown even our debt situation will be more stable, not less stable, if we seize this moment with vision and purpose. And so tonight, I'd like to talk to you about our way forward, a two-step plan of rescue and recovery, a two-step plan to build a bridge to the other side of the crisis we face to a better, stronger, more secure America. Tonight, I'll lay out my first step, the American Rescue Plan, that will tackle the pandemic and get direct financial assistance and relief to Americans who need it the most. Next month, my first appearance before a joint session of Congress, I will lay out my Build Back Better Recovery Plan. It'll make historic investments in infrastructure, that Build Back Better Plan, infrastructure, manufacturing, innovation, research and development, and clean energy, investments in a caregiving economy and skills and training needed by our workers to be able to compete and win in the global economy of the coming years. Moody's, an independent Wall Street firm, said my approach will create more than 18 million good-paying jobs. Our rescue and recovery plan is a path forward with both seriousness of purpose and a clear plan with transparency and accountability, with a call for unity that is equally necessary. And unity is not some pie-in-the-sky dream. It's a practical step to getting the things we have to get done as a country get done together. As I said when it passed in December, the bipartisan COVID-19 relief package was a very important first step. I'm grateful for the Democrats, Republicans, and independent members of Congress who came together to get it done. But I said at the time, it's just a down payment. We need more action, more bipartisanship, And we need to move quickly. We need to move fast. Our rescue plan starts aggressively in order to speed up our national COVID-19 response. The vaccines offer so much hope, and we're grateful to the scientists and researchers and everyone who participated in the clinical trials. We're also grateful for the rigorous review and testing that has led to millions of people around the world already being vaccinated safely. But the vaccine rollout in the United States has been a dismal failure thus far. Tomorrow, I will lay out our vaccination plan to correct course and meet our goal of 100 million shots at the end of my first 100 days as president. This will be one of the most challenging operational efforts we have ever undertaken as a nation. We'll have to move heaven and earth to get more people vaccinated, to create more places for them to get vaccinated, to mobilize more medical teams to get shots in people's arms, to increase vaccine supply, and to get it out the door as fast as possible. We'll also do everything we can to keep our educators and students safe, to safely reopen a majority of our K-8 schools by the end of the first 100 days. We can do this if we give the school districts, the schools themselves, the communities, the states, the clear guidance they need, as well as the resources they need that they can't afford right now because of the economic dilemma they're in. That means more testing and transportation, additional cleaning and sanitizing services in those schools, protective equipment and ventilation systems in those schools. We need to make sure that workers who have COVID-19 symptoms are quarantined, and those who need to take care of their family members with COVID-19 symptoms should be able to stay home from work and still get paid. This will reduce the spread of the virus and make sure workers get the support they need to maintain their families. But we need about $400 billion in funding from Congress to make all of what I just said happen. It's a great deal, but I'm convinced we are ready to get this done. The very health of our nation is at stake. Our rescue plan also includes immediate relief to Americans hardest hit and most in need. We will finish the job of getting a total of $2,000 in cash relief to people who need it the most. The $600 already appropriated is simply not enough. You just have to choose between paying rent and putting food on the table. Even for those who've kept their jobs, these checks are really important. You see, if you're an American worker making $40,000 a year with less than $400 in savings, maybe you've lost hours, or maybe you're doing fewer shifts, driving a truck or caring for the kids or the elderly. You're out there putting your life on the line to work during this pandemic and worried every week that you get sick, lose your job, or worse. $2,000 is going to go a long way to ease that pain. We'll also provide more peace of mind for struggling families by extending unemployment insurance beyond the end of March for millions of workers. That means that 18 million Americans currently rely on unemployment benefits, while they look for work, can count on these checks continuing to be there. Plus, there will be a $400 per week supplement so people can make ends meet. This gets money quickly into the pockets of millions of Americans who will spend it immediately on food and rent and other basic needs. As the economists tell us, that helps the whole economy grow. We'll also tackle the growing hunger crisis in America. As I speak, and the Vice President-elect has spoken to this many times, 1 in 7 households in America, more than 1 in 5 Black and Latino households in America, report they don't have enough food to eat. This includes 30 million adults and as many as 12 million children. It's wrong. It's tragic. It's unnecessary. It's unacceptable. So we're going to extend emergency nutritional assistance for 43 million children and their families enrolled in the SNAP program through the rest of this year. We'll help hard-hit restaurants prepare meals for the hungry, provide food for the families who need it. We will invest $3 billion in making sure mothers and their young children have the nutrition they need. This will not only meet our moral obligation we have to one another, but it will also spur our economic growth, get restaurants and workers back on the job. And as we work to keep people from going hungry, we'll also work to keep a roof over their heads, to stem the growing housing crisis and evictions that are looming. Approximately 14 million Americans have fallen behind on rent, many at risk of eviction. If we don't act now, there'll be a wave of evictions and foreclosures in the coming months as the pandemic rages on. This would overwhelm emergency shelters, increase COVID-19 infections as people have nowhere to go and can't socially distance. Next week, we'll take action to extend nationwide restrictions on evictions and foreclosures. This will provide more than 25 million Americans greater stability instead of living on the edge every single month. And I'm asking Congress to do its part by funding rental assistance for 14 million hard-hit families and tenants. It will also be a bridged economic recovery for countless mom-and-pop landlords. These crises are straining the budgets of states and cities and tribal communities that are forced to consider layoff and service restrictions of the most needed workers. It means that people putting their lives at risk are the very people now at risk of losing their jobs. Police officers, firefighters, all first responders, nurses, educators. You know, over the last year alone, over 600,000 educators have lost their jobs in our cities and towns. Our rescue plan will provide emergency funding to keep these essential workers on the job and maintain essential services. It will ensure that vaccines are administered and schools can reopen. Vice President-elect Harris and I have been speaking with county officials, mayors, governors of both parties on a regular basis. We're ready to work with them, help them get the relief they need. Our rescue plan will also help small businesses that are the engines of our economic growth, our economy as a whole, the glue that holds communities together as well. But they're hurting badly. And you realize they account for nearly half of the entire total U.S. workforce. Our rescue plan will provide flexible grants to help those hardest hit small businesses survive the pandemic, and the low-cost capital that will help entrepreneurs of all backgrounds create and maintain jobs, plus provide the essential goods and services that communities depend upon. Last week, I laid out how we'll make sure that our emergency small business relief is distributed swiftly and equitably, unlike the first time around. We're going to focus on small businesses on Main Street. We'll focus on minority-owned small businesses, women-owned small businesses, and finally having equal access to the resources they need to reopen and to rebuild. And we will be responsible with taxpayers' dollars, ensuring accountability that reduces waste and fraud and abuse like we did in the Recovery Act that I administered in our administration. Direct cash payments, extended unemployment insurance, rent relief, food assistance, keeping essential frontline workers on the job, aid to small businesses. These are the key elements to the American Rescue Plan that would lift 12 million Americans out of poverty and cut child poverty in half. That's 5 million children lifted out of poverty if we move. Our plan will reduce poverty in the Black community by one-third, reduce poverty in the Hispanic community by almost 40%, and includes much more, like an increase in the minimum wage to at least $15 an hour. People tell me that's going to be hard to pass. Florida just passed it. As divided as that state is, they just passed it. The rest of the country is ready to move as well. It should be a national minimum wage of $15 an hour. No one working 40 hours a week should live below the poverty line. That's what it means. If you work for less than $15 an hour and work 40 hours a week, you're living in poverty. It includes access to affordable child care that will enable parents, particularly women, to get back to work. I look forward to working with members of Congress, of both parties, to move quickly to get the American Rescue Plan to the American people. And then we can move with equal urgency and bipartisanship to my Build Back Better recovery plan that I will call for next month to generate even more economic growth. American manufacturing was the arsenal of democracy in World War II. It will be so again. Imagine a future made in America, all made in America, and all by Americans. We'll use taxpayers' dollars to rebuild America. We'll buy American products, supporting millions of American manufacturing jobs, enhancing our competitive strength in an increasingly competitive world. Imagine historic investments in research and development to sharpen America's innovative edge in markets where global leadership is up for grabs, markets like the battery technology, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, clean energy. Imagine confronting the climate crisis with American jobs and ingenuity leading the world. It's time to stop talking about infrastructure and to finally start building an infrastructure so we can be more competitive. Millions of good-paying jobs that put Americans to work rebuilding our roads, our bridges, our ports to make them more climate resilient, to make them faster, cheaper, cleaner, to transport American-made goods across our country and around the world. That's how we compete. And imagine millions of jobs in a caregiving economy to ease the financial burden of caring for young children and aged loved ones. Let's make sure our caregivers, mostly women, women of color, immigrants, have the same pay and dignity that they deserve. So we can do these bold, practical things now. Now. You know, I know what I just described does not come cheaply, but failure to do so will cost us dearly. The consensus among leading economists is we simply cannot afford not to do what I'm proposing. Independent, respected institutions from around the world, from the Federal Reserve to the International Monetary Fund, have underscored the urgency. Even Wall Street firms have reinforced the logic. If we invest now boldly, smartly, and with unwavering focus on American workers and families, we will strengthen our economy, reduce inequity, and put our nation's long-term finances on the most sustainable course. And where we're making permanent investments, recurring investments, as I said in the campaign trail, we will pay for that by making sure that everyone pays their fair share, not punishing anybody. We can do it without punishing a single person by closing tax loopholes for companies that ship jobs overseas, or to allow American companies, 90 of them, the top Fortune 500, to pay zero in federal income taxes, asking everyone to pay their fair share at the top so we can make permanent investments to rescue and rebuild America. It's the right thing for our economy. It's the fair thing. It's the decent thing to do. We not only have an economic imperative to act now, I believe we have a moral obligation. In this pandemic, in America, we cannot let people go hungry. We cannot let people get evicted. We cannot watch nurses, educators, and others lose their jobs. We so badly need them. We must act now and act decisively. My fellow Americans, the decisions we make in the next few weeks and months are going to determine whether we thrive in a way that benefits all Americans, or that we stay stuck in a place where those at the top do great, while economic growth for most everyone else is just a spectator sport, and where American prospects dim, not brighten. These investments will determine whether we reassert American leadership and outcompete our competitors in a global economy. We're better equipped to do this than any nation in the world. Or that we watch them catch up and pass us by. Together, I know which path we'll choose. That includes all Americans, so we can own the 21st century. But even with all of these bold steps, it's going to take time to get where we need to be. There will be stumbles, but I will always be honest with you about both the progress we're making and what setbacks we meet. And there will, and here's the deal, the more people we vaccinate, the faster we do it, the sooner we can save lives and put this pandemic behind us and get back to our lives and our loved ones. And the sooner we can rescue and rebuild the American economy, the biggest and most profitable engine in the world. I know it's been nearly a year that tested us beyond measure. For all of you who have lost someone, my heart goes out to you. I know that feeling, looking at an empty chair across the table. All of you have fallen on hard times. I know you can never get back what you lost. But as your president, I know that every day matters and every person matters. From the very first to the nearly 400,000 lost American souls and counting, to the millions of you just looking for a fighting chance in this economy, I promise you, we will not forget you. We understand what you're going through. We will never, ever give up. And we will come back. We'll come back together. Well, we didn't get into all this overnight. We won't get out of it overnight. And we can't do it as a separated and divided nation. The only way we can do it is to come together, as fellow Americans, as neighbors, as the United States of America. And when we do, there's nothing beyond our capacity. I've said this many times. When America acts as one, there's never been a single thing we've been unable to do, no matter how consequential the issue has been. Out of all the peril of this moment, I want you to know, I give you a word, I see the promise as well. We've seen clearly what we face now. And I remain so optimistic about America, as optimistic as I've ever been. We have everything we need. But the will must be demonstrated. So come Wednesday, we begin a new chapter. The Vice President-elect and I will do our best to meet all the expectations you have for the country and the expectations we have for it. I'm confident. I am truly confident. Together, we can get this done and come out better off than when we went into this crisis. God bless you all. May God protect our troops.
President-elect Biden speaking live from Wilmington, Delaware tonight with a clear assessment of the awful state of affairs on so many fronts across our nation. The economy in deep trouble, the virus spreading in a way we haven't seen heretofore, and the vaccine rollout, as he put it, a dismal failure, ranked very close to, if not the worst, in all the world. The president-elect with a series of plans to rescue us. The American Rescue Plan at the top of his list. The Build Back Better plan, as he put it. And a vaccine rollout plan, a vaccine distribution plan with specifics and tone, the likes of which we have not heard since this pandemic began. And in the end, a nod toward hope. Getting the vaccine shots in arms, recovering the economy, beginning a broad-based and widespread infrastructure plan, the kind of thing that's been discussed but never acted upon, to rebuild our roads and bridges and bring America back up to 21st century standards. Of course, it will cost a lot of money and will take time, and the president-elect has said so. And it will not come without division and pushback in Washington. It's the kind of money that many conservatives will say we must be able to do better. But for now, clearly, concisely, a plan and a process and a bit of hope. Some analysis now. CNBC's Kayla Tausche with some of the details as laid out by the president-elect tonight. Kayla?
Well, Shep, to deal with all of those competing crises, the president-elect laid out plans in a proposal for the second largest spending package in American history, second only to the CARES Act passed this last spring. He wants to pass it in weeks, not the seven-plus months that the last bipartisan package, half its size, took. It's a Herculean effort in any times, no doubt a Herculean effort right now with a global pandemic underway and an impeachment trial that is set to begin on Capitol Hill. But what we saw, Shep, was an entirely different style of governance and deal-making on display tonight. The president-elect taking his pitch directly to the American people, trying to shore up their support in the court of public opinion before sitting down at the negotiating table with members of Congress on either side of the aisle in hopes that perhaps some of these constituents will call up their representatives and say, I like what I heard tonight, and I want you to vote for it. This is something we should expect to see a lot from the president-elect as he pitches not only this plan, but one of even larger scope and a larger price tag down the line. We'll see if it works, and we'll see how much support he can get. Shep?
Kayla, thanks so much. $1.9 trillion, and the president-elect called it but a down payment. Let's look at the economics of this. CNBC's chief economics correspondent, Steve Leisman, is with us now. Steve, mighty expensive.
It's a lot of money. I'm not even sure it's all needed, but I think, Chip, you have to take a step back and think about this is some new cutting-edge economics that are drawn, especially by the Democrats, from lessons from the financial crisis. You heard what Kayla said. The idea that they did not spend enough money in 08 and 09, that led to bad results over the course of the rest of the Obama presidency is something that has haunted Democrats for a long time. So the idea is throw as much money at it as you can. Maybe it's not all needed, but because interest rates are so low, it won't matter that much. There's two thoughts behind this, Shep, which are really new thinking in economics. It doesn't sound like Biden, who talks in such a folksy way, is really given an economics lesson there, but he is. First, he's saying, you know what? The government can borrow essentially at zero, and every dollar we get, every bit of growth we get on top of that is payback of that, so it pays for itself. The other thing is that if you don't do it, you end up costing the government more. That is, if you end up being cheap about putting stimulus in the economy, that you end up having tax revenue end up being worse than if you did spend the money. Finally, one more thing, Shep. He said every day matters. I think of that as an economist, economics reporter, that when people lose their work, Shep, they can't get that day, that month, that year back in their lives. So the idea of getting people back to work as quickly as possible is really good economics.
Steve Leisman on economics for us tonight. Steve, thanks so much. We shall see the level of resistance that with which this is met, and we'll see how it plays across America in the days ahead. But if nothing else, from the highest office in the land, a plan and some empathy. A new day starts on Wednesday. First tonight, a new NBC News poll finds 8% of Republican voters believe that Joe Biden should be the next, or I should say, believe that President Trump should be impeached. Just 8%. Senators are now weighing in on whether they will convict him. Some breaking from the Republican Party. So what does the path forward look like? Plus, no checked guns, no booze on board at all. With in-flight violence on the rise, our major airlines are rolling out new rules as the news continues right after this. President Trump's second impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate could start next week. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says January 19th is the earliest it would begin. 17 Republican votes would be needed to convict the president. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the latest to give her view today, writing in a statement, "The House has responded swiftly and I believe appropriately with impeachment." She goes on, "I will listen carefully and consider the arguments of both sides and will then announce how I'll vote." Republican voters largely side with the president. See this, a new NBC News poll shows 8% of Republicans say that the president should be impeached and removed from office. Another poll from Axios shows 41% of traditional GOP voters say they think President Trump should be the 2024 Republican candidate. Mike Murphy now, NBC News analyst, Republican strategist who advised Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, and John McCain Mike's been a vocal critic of President Trump. Mike, you heard the president-elect's plan for building back and bringing us a recovery. Your top-line thoughts on what he just said, if you would.
Vintage Joe Biden. It's kind of meat and potatoes Democratic policy and empathy. You know, he feels the pain, and that's always been his political trademark. I think he's trying to set the agenda for his term fast, and I thought it was an effective move to do that. He's going to get some headwinds on Capitol Hill because the Republicans are going to rediscover their fiscal conservatives. They kind of put that in escrow during the Trump years and have some concerns about the spending. But Biden's making a big move here, which I think is smart. Now, we know about COVID-19 politics. The rhetoric gets you a little. It's action and results that'll move the numbers. So he's, you know, and he said this is not going to be easy. If he can perform the big lift and get the country quickly vaccinated, he will have a big economic comeback, and that'll work very well for him. But, you know, it's not easy.
Well, on this pushback, on the pushback that you mentioned, Republicans have largely been for infrastructure improvement. President Trump had many, many, many infrastructure weeks, though we never really anything really ever came of them. Maybe there won't be too much pushback there. Yeah. But specifically, if you could, where do you believe the president will see this these headwinds? In what lanes?
Pretty much the price tag. There's a bit of an argument between the size of the checks versus extending unemployment benefits. A lot of people on the right argue the money ought to go to unemployed people, not employed people. So maybe a $600 check is more appropriate than $1,500 or $2,000. But there's divided opinion. You got, I think, Marco, others have been out saying the larger checks. I think it's the global price tag of $1.9 trillion at a time where we have record deficits. On the other hand, Steve was right, your economic expert, that almost every expert of right and left says in one of these situations, faster money is better than later money because you get in a hole that costs more to dig out of. So, you know, I think he doesn't need that many Republicans. You know, he's got the appropriators in the House with her majority, Speaker Pelosi, and he's got a narrow majority. I think one of his political problems will be some people on his left in the Senate, you know, in that 51 vote universe they're going to be in, saying not enough, you know, and then he's going to have Republicans saying not so much. But he might, I think he can probably find his 51, 52, 53 votes to get, you know, two thirds to three quarters of what he wants. The tax fight will be the bigger fight to pay for it.
I'm out of time, but real quickly, the people who are still so upset that the president is leaving office, will they be able to say, at least I like the tone, or is that too much?
No, I think so. I think Biden is the anti-Trump in that way, and I know there's a lot of polling going on. Just quickly, you know, I saw that Axios poll, and polls are always the rearview mirror. You got to give stuff time to cook.
Yeah.
But that poll also says that 6 out of 10 Republicans are done with Trump and ready to move on. That is a big number, and I think the president is starting to melt here, and, you know, it's just going to take time to do.
A few days ahead. Mike, thanks so much. Appreciate the time. The FAA tells CNBC it's been a disturbing increase that it's seen now in passenger disruptions on flights, some serious ones. Some of them related to mask policies, but others related to last week's riot at the Capitol. The agency's zero tolerance policy is now in effect, and many airlines are adding their own rules ahead of the inauguration. Here's CNBC's Phil LeBeau.
An aviation security crackdown, with airlines beefing up plans to handle unruly passengers.
We've increased the amount of security, both in the airports and in the sky, seen and unseen. And we're going to be taking some additional measures here in the coming days as we look to the week ahead.
Delta will no longer let passengers check firearms on flights to Washington. It has also banned the people who heckled Senator Mitt Romney as he waited to board a Delta flight.
You're a joke. Absolute joke. It's disgusting shame.
Overall, airlines are telling more people, you got out of hand, you won't fly us again. United putting 60 on its no-fly list in the last week. Alaska banning 16 unruly passengers who acted up on a flight to Washington. The airline now limiting tickets to the nation's capital. While Americans' flights to the D.C. area will stop serving alcohol. For Steve Dixon, who runs the FAA, enough is enough.
This is about flight safety. And any time we see a trend like this, we need to take action, because traveling on a commercial airline in the United States is the safest form of travel in human history. And I want to make sure it stays that way.
Three airlines are now forbidding passengers from checking firearms if they are on a flight to Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, Alaska Airlines has set up a command center. That command center will monitor the entire process from the gate to getting on board to getting to Washington of every single flight. That way, Shep, if there is an incident, they will call the authorities immediately.
Phil LeBeau, thanks very much. 55 seconds left on a race to the finish. President-elect Biden just laid out his COVID relief plan live on CNBC. He's calling for another round of stimulus checks as part of his $1.9 trillion spending package. And the former FDA commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, in this news hour, warned that if the United States doesn't get vaccines into arms soon, we could face what he calls perpetual infections because of virus mutations. Meaning, in short, it's time to follow the Fauci. And now you know the news. Of this Thursday, January the 14th, 2021, I'm Shepard Smith. Follow us on Twitter at The News on CNBC. Shark Tank is next. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.